Hey everyone, welcome back to No Killing Goblins, with your hosts, Dragonus and Oshi.
Howdy everybody.
I am not Dragonus, and that was not Oshi. So, I guess we can get... I don't know, I was trying to do a joke, I failed.
No comment.
Oh god, come on, where's my... You're supposed to be my ride or die bitch, not poke fun at Oshi bitch.
Really? Show me where that is in the contract. We made when we made this podcast. Oh wait, there is no contract.
Watch me write a contract that says that and make you sign it. Okay, it's been a very quiet week for me. How's it been for you, Dragonus?
Loud.
Why has it been loud?
Because somebody I work with is very loud and obnoxious. It's that person who rides the bicycle and then they stick a stick in the front spoke and they fly off and they hurt their knee and then they start saying "damn you, blank." Guy's been doing that for like a month. You know what? Work bullshit. It's been work bullshit. Some people just are not fit to breed. I don't know.
Wow, the rage. I can feel it. I've had other disasters. My refrigerator fan just stopped working. So now my freezer works, but the bottom half doesn't work. And I had a full-on panic attack because it happened late at night enough that I couldn't do anything about it. And I discovered something about myself. I am one of those people who needs to be able to do something about problems. And even if it's just a little thing, otherwise the anxiety will fucking wreck me. Maybe I should have realized this earlier in my life.
Might help.
Outside of that, there's been another chapter from Pirate ABBA that was released that we both enjoyed, right?
Oh, yeah. That one caught me a bit by surprise.
And I think San Diego Comic-Con happened. It happened a while ago, but this is the first time I'm talking about it. Did you see the trailer for the new D&D movie?
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Everybody keeps saying either they're optimistic or they just won't go to the theaters to see it because they've been burned before. And my opinion remains that they're trying to capture the fun of a tabletop game and then still make it some kind of Lord of the Rings epic fantasy. And all I can tell you is don't fucking do it.
You see, I think it's interesting because I don't think they're trying to capture the fun of a D&D tabletop game. I think they're trying to capture the fun of making all that money Guardians of the Galaxy did.
Okay, now that's even worse. Because if you had focused on the interactivity between the people, the characters, made it about the characters, made it irreverent, and let the epicness, the attempt to make it Lord of the Rings go, it would have been a fun. Instead, you're right. They're turning it into a Marvel movie, and I don't like that.
I don't see where you're getting Lord of the Rings from. Absolutely nothing in this made me think they were aiming for the level of self-importance, grandeur, or pageantry that you get from, like, Lord of the Rings conceptually. This was absolutely fantasy action comedy, the trailer from the ground up. And they very clearly are kind of taking the piss a little bit, just trying to have some fun with it, and then throw in Dungeons & Dragons references, which I will then probably have to explain to new players unto the end of time. No, it doesn't actually work that way, because, you know, God hates me, and I hate myself, and I keep volunteering to teach new people.
I'm using Lord of the Rings as a reference for epic fantasy in film.
This isn't an epic fantasy, though.
I know it's not epic fantasy, but it's trying to do that thing where they're saying, there's going to be an epic film, and we're all going to make jokes.
I don't think that that's what they're saying, Oshi.
I'll disagree with you. Moving on, so other news out of San Diego Comic-Con, what came? I know they dropped the trailer for the next House of Dragons thing for the Game of Thrones spinoff.
Oh yeah, no one cares.
No one cares.
No one cares. There was a whole bunch of stuff from Marvel. The only thing that really caught my interest through is that they did the fourth wall breaks in the upcoming She-Hulk show, which is really all I wanted. I want, like, the classic comedy superhero lawyer fourth wall joke cracking, poking fun at her own self-important medium, She-Hulk. It's what I'm here for.
Okay. For me, the only panel or anything of interest for me was the Mythic Quest panel. Do you know what Mythic Quest is?
Nope.
So Mythic Quest is this TV show about a game developer produced by one of the main folks from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I wouldn't say it's like perfect comedy or anything like that, but it's really, really good. It's about this guy who's a copy of every self-important game developer you could think of, and all the shit that happens in our culture around the development of like an MMO and how it works and how games are changed and the people around it. It's just such a well done and funny show. I wish it got more. And Danny Putty's in it from the Community. You remember him? Yeah. I liked it, and they had a panel, and it was hilariously fun to watch the panel. So, or at least the secretly done video of the panel. I don't think there's been much stuff happening recently that I want to talk about that isn't depressing.
And I mean, there was some other stuff I vaguely remember dropping. I don't know if it was at San Diego Comic Con or not, but I was real excited to see new Shazam stuff. Like, I thought the first Shazam was just about a perfect little superhero movie, so.
Oh, speaking of superhero things, so I recently, I don't know if I should talk about this. You know what? Fuck it. You guys will live with it. So I recently saw The Boys season 3, and the start of the season had this incredibly horrific and at the same time mildly sexy scene, which is very much The Boys theme to everything. And I don't know if we've already talked about it. Maybe I did talk about it.
We've talked about The Boys before. I try to avoid talking too much about anything past, like, the basic premise, if only because, one, a lot of, like, the value they get out of it is sort of catching people in these moments of shock, and I don't want to spoil it.
Right, but the reason I mention it is because The Boys made me go watch Ms. Marvel, which is a whole different thing because it's Disney, it's nothing. But so Ms. Marvel is based off of the newest variation of Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan. Kamala, if you're South Asian. And the whole show is on Disney Plus, and it's about a young Pakistani girl who grows up in Jersey City. It was fun to watch. I mean, it's very it's very much teenage superhero thing, but I liked it.
Yeah, no, I am a huge fan of Ms. Marvel in the comics. Kamala Khan and Miles Morales. Kamala Khan and Miles Morales are the only two characters I felt like Marvel was able to consistently get right and have be enjoyable to read for the longest fucking time. To the point where I've kind of given up on reading most comic books, but like, if I see them, I will still grab them and read them. And the show was all right. It felt a little, I don't know, like just do Homecoming, but let's do it with Kamala Khan instead. But the actress is great. The show was interesting enough. It stuck its landing better than just about every other Marvel show has, even if it had its own flaws. I'll give it credit for that. None of these shows know how to gracefully end their fucking series.
Because they're not designed to end, they're supposed to be like forever, and they always sort of fuck that part up. I mean, the ultimate one being Scarlet Witch's one.
WandaVision?
Yeah, WandaVision for the first 5 episodes was like experimental, amazing, dope, fucking hell. It was so good. And the reveal at the end where it was Agatha all along remains one of the best ones ever.
Beautiful.
But the ending was very Marvel and not in a good way.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on the fucking ending of that show. I still am consistently deeply annoyed with the way it just gave fucking Wanda a pass for all the bullshit she'd done, and it's one of the reasons why I love Multiverse of Madness so much. Anyways, if we are just gonna keep getting sidetracked talking about different kinds of superheroes.
I have non-superhero stuff. So I've been trying to watch less fantasy, more grounded reality shows. So one of the ones that which did not work, by the way, I ended up watching Paper Girls, which is a time traveling YA show about based on a Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang comic book. Go watch it. It's fun. I actually watched it because Ali Wong is in it. Do you know who Ali Wong is?
Vaguely.
She's the comedian who did. She's just a comedian. You know what? I don't have time to go into it. But yeah, she's a comedian. She's amazing. And I watched it, and of course she's funny. And then the kids are great, and the storyline works for me, so I loved it. But like I said, I was trying to watch non-stuff, and one of the things that came up because I canceled Netflix last month, but I went back because somebody recommended this show for me, Uncoupled, and Neil Patrick Harris, who I don't love, was the main character, and I wanted to just take a look at it. Yeah, folks, don't invest too much. I don't even know how to say this. It's like Sex in the City for gay folks, but not as good. Yeah, and Sex in the City was not great. And this is written by somebody who's 75 years old and thinks millennials are bad. It was an experience. Just not gonna put myself through it again. Yeah, that was it. That's it for me for TV watches, because that's all I've been doing, de-stressing from the refrigerator stuff.
Hey, sometimes you just gotta kick back and relax.
Well, I mean, I did have 5 days off. Today's my first day back at work after. Okay, so we are actually going to. Actually, we have reader email.
We do?
We have listener email, sorry. Yeah, we have a couple. Discanter sent us one, and we got one from a person that were signed off as Creative Closer here. All right, I'll read that one while you look over Dragoness's one. It's starred, by the way, in the Gmail.
Wait, will I look over Dragoness's one? I'm confused now.
Oh, sorry. Let's look over the one Discanter sent. You can tell I'm still okay. Greetings, Oshi and Dragoness or Dragoness. First off, I'm very glad you're back, Dragoness. Second, again, I'm caught up on everything that I'm reading. Just for the record, that is Beneath the Dragoneye Moon, Salvos, Azeroth here. There's no epic loot here, only puns. The Mark of the Fool and Millennial Mage. Out of that list, I've never read Millennial Mage. And I stopped reading Salvos a long time ago. And Azeroth here. And there is no epic loot here, but only puns. Are those good? Have you ever read Millennial Mage?
I'm not familiar with any of them.
Oh, I'm surprised. Okay. I am as current as a non-paying reader of TWI can be. I just started the Zombie Knight saga to read between updates. Not quite sure how I feel about that one quite yet. Now that that is out of the way, on to classes. I feel that I need to defend the Layabout class. It seems that most people seem to think that it is a useless class. First, would the system have a completely useless class? Yes. Even the Prisoner and Serf classes have skills to help with survival. Second, what about. Okay, I can't say this name or introduce this character, but it's a particular character who is introduced at a later point and has a moniker that would indicate they have some kind of layabout class. Yes, I do admit that that person exists, but I honestly didn't connect the two. Because there was no, like. I don't know, I just didn't connect the two. Anyway, email goes on. I took it as a challenge to think of uses or skills for the Stirrer class. This one was a little harder until I thought of Shion's cooking skills from Tensai Sh. What the fuck is this?
No, that actually makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Tensai Shitari Slime Dr. Ken. What if the Stirrer class could mix monster part and people by using a form of genetic mutation? Maybe Stirrers could create skills by mixing them. Anyways, I could see it leading nicely to Flesh Shaper or skill creation with creative application. I could see it leading to something truly amazing if it is truly a goblin-only skill. Anyway, on to clowns. First off, I've never seen been one to have a fear of clowns. Of course, this could be because I was friends with the local clown group when I was younger. Wow. All right. The tricks and props that can go into the acts are amazing. The use of sleight of hand and misdirection used is very impressive to watch. That was my general impression of clowns. Pirate Abba wrote one of the first clown scenes to ever make me feel any fear from clowns. I swear I could hear the music and laughter while reading. Dragoness, you mentioned mimes being the least creepy clown type. In There Is No Epic Loot Here, Only Puns, there is a mime that is a ghoul. Would that make the inherent nature of mimes more or less creepy in your opinion?
I mean, probably more, but ghouls make everything creepier.
Yeah. All right. You're on for Mr. Drag. I don't have it. I mean, I reacted as I read it, so I don't got anything. What read Discanter's thing.
Discanter's is much shorter, but it is a great trick for trying to get people to read wandering in. Since you want email responses, here's one, though I guess it's cheating because the episode isn't out yet, and I'm only partway through editing it. I market the Wandering Inn to my friends by telling them it is the grandest, most epic fantasy ever read. Yes, it's slice of life, but it's a slice of everybody's life. Everywhere. The whole world is important, and we get to see and experience more of it than in any other work. Which I kind of agree. Yeah, that's one of the big selling points.
I'm sticking with slice of life war crimes. That's how I sell it. It's a good trick to sell it. Yeah, I love that shit. All right. So we have 10 minutes and we're going to talk about something. This is going to be a long episode. I've just accepted it. We're trying to get a new segment going about books, and we're all going to read books. And this week, Discanter was the one who picked the book. Sorry, not Discanter.
You maybe want me to do the intro here.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Yes, please. Please.
All right, so we've got a new sort of section coming up where we're just going to talk a little bit about books. Sometimes we'll try to talk about a book we both read, maybe only one of us has read. We were just going to kind of wing it and talk about just books because we all like books and you do too. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here listening to us talk about one big book. So today, I actually had picked what I wanted to talk us to talk about. Mostly because, one, it's a story I try and get people to read every chance I can, and the author is just this really great guy, and I'm always trying to push people towards his work, and it's called Interviewing Leather. It's one of the best places to sort of get into this larger Justice Wing universe that he has, which is this world of superheroes and villains. It feels a lot like somebody sort of took all of these ideas about superheroes and all the sort of craziness and has tried to make something really coherent and interesting out of it. And this particular story starts with a very small little slice of area that is a guy named Todd Chapman. He is a vaguely sycophantic writer for a magazine that's not quite the Rolling Stone because it's not good enough to be the Rolling Stone. And one day his boss tells him that he needs to go, instead of interviewing some rock star or rapper, he is going to go interview a supervillain. And then he gets kidnapped and things get complicated from there. That sound about right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's 11 chapters. It's free online. It's on a site called banterlatte.com. And there's a revised version, and it's fairly quick read. It's fun. And I enjoyed it. That's pretty much my entire thing. I should have more to say about it, but honestly, that's where I was. It just didn't feel like.
Oh, she's suffering from near-on brain death at this point, I think.
Yeah, it's been a lot of. I don't know. I don't know what the fuck's going on with me. Maybe I'm sick.
Yeah, we'll have to definitely get you to a hospital or something. You sound like you're about to die.
I'm not dying. I'm just not in my. Not everybody can be on all the time tracking this. Some of us have, like, moments of stupidity.
Oh, no, I'm aware with that. Every moment I have is a moment of stupidity by definition. But the story, like, it's framed as Todd Chapman getting kidnapped for an interview, but what it's really about is about how, like, supervillains actually turn a profit. There's a great scene where they're talking about what they're gonna make money-wise for robbing a jewelry heist, and they're like, yeah, no, jewels pay for shit. You rob them because, like, it gets your name in the press, but we're gonna get pennies on the dollar for this. Like, we made no money last night.
It's weirdly like, it's like taking the practicalities of being a superhero and putting it out and finding the comedy and the reality in it. And that's a clever way to like get people. I mean, it's a common theme in superhero media in the last decade or so to like subvert a lot of the superhero stuff by talking about what it's like.
Yeah.
Now I remember why I was talking about, why I was thinking about The Boys. It's because the scene at the start of season three, it linked back to Interviewing Leather because look, practicalities. Look at what you could do. You could use powers for, you know what it was. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, you could use powers for all sorts of things, and one thing that does come up is that it's actually really difficult to have a relationship with someone that doesn't have superpowers. If you're so strong, you could casually break them in a sexual encounter.
Exactly.
Which is, definitely a the point where they're discussing that's a big one. I really do think that I'm gonna have to spoil this a bit to get people to read and check out everything else. But so there's some. There is some discussion of that kind of thing, and just the realities of it. And this actually was originally written all the way back in 2007. So it's definitely always been ahead of its curve in that way. And also, yeah, diamonds and jewels are a great example of how hard it can be to make money as a supervillain. Interesting that that was the very first thing that they did when they had a hold of Chapman. The thing, though, is it's really more Leather's story in more ways than just the difficulties of being a supervillain, because it also does a lot of time thinking about how and why somebody becomes a supervillain. Leather definitely had a rough time of things trying to be a better person, and there is actually something that gets said by another character in another one of these stories that I think really encapsulates a lot of what this story is about. What is the difference between a noble villain and an asshole hero?
I didn't realize this was written in 2007, but it makes a lot of sense because a lot of the more well-developed writing tends to come as a leading edge to the more mass media stuff. Mass media is always about 20, 10 to 15 years behind what is the front of the curve, so to speak, because nobody wants to take risks. And superhero media in the 2000s was like a big deal in on the internet sphere because wasn't that when like Worm and stuff was being written?
I think I don't have all the dates exactly lined up, but actually this a lot of the ideas superhero wise go all the way back to the 90s and the old Super Guy stuff, which predates me. This guy's kind of been a staple on the internet for about as long as it's been the internet.
Huh?
I don't know if anybody here is a big web comic person, but if anybody from the like mid early 2000s recognizes the WebSnark website, this guy and his wife are the same people.
That's very cool.
Yeah, no, it's kind of funny. I've been following this guy since something, give or take, like being 14 years old, which is surreal to say out loud.
That's me and who's the word I'm looking for? Ilona Andrews. I've been reading them for over a decade and a half. Oh my God, it really has. When did I start? Whenever the first book came out, which was so long ago. God.
Anyways, I definitely recommend checking this out. There's another story called Being the Steve, which makes more sense in context once you know what the job Steve is, that also takes place at the same time and fleshes more stuff out. There is a sequel to this wherein the it's called Interviewing Trey, and it's about Todd Chapman getting kidnapped by a supervillain again, only this one is much less fun. There's a midquel type thing I think you specifically should read, Oshi. It is exactly the next thing I think you should read if you ever read this guy's stuff again. It's called Kitten House Rules, and it is Todd doing a single longer article, no kidnapping or supervillains involved, where he is working and interviewing and profiling a famous in-universe feminist punk band. They're called the Cheshire Kittens. All members must be female and must express as parahuman, or identify as female, to be specific. And just on his way to go interview them and do this profile, one of their founding members walks away. It digs a lot into the social environment of the setting post the apocalypse agenda, and just sort of the unequal treatment involved in being a parahuman. Because, God, it really sucks if the only thing you have as a superpower is that you can be on pitch at all times and play any instrument you ever pick up, but they won't let you play chess because they can't prove you can't also play chess perfectly. And God forbid you actually have a power that could be useful, like turning invisible. Welcome to being responsible for every crime that ever happens in your entire city again.
I mean, that is a sad thing.
It is, and this digs a lot into it, and I think it specifically would appeal to you and be the next spot to read.
Okay. It does have that bittersweet quality that I love. Okay, let's move on. We're at the 30-minute mark. I think we have to move on.
One last thing I do want to say, though, is if you do wind up reading any of this and liking it, Eric and his wife have a Wednesday have a Patreon. I think of it as some of the best money for a Patreon I personally spend. He does a lot of write streaming, but he also doesn't do the traditional, weekly or bi-weekly post-ups. Generally, he writes stuff, he edits it, and then he posts it up when it's done. More of a traditional kind of a thing there. So, definitely is really cool to be able to read a lot of this stuff in progress. And there's also still just a ton of stories already up on here. And I would recommend everybody check it out. I'll be sure to stick a link in all the bio stuff
Cool.
for the Banter Latte site.
Okay, you're doing the upload for everything on this episode. Let's move on to the Wandering Inn. I mean, that's what we're here to discuss, right? And we're gonna try and cover three chapters today, and we're gonna start off with what I think is the most significant. I mean, I keep saying that.
I think we're going to try in vain because this interlude is really cool and has a lot of big reveals in it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a lot of revelatory information, but when you dig into it, it isn't much more than it's a lot of revelatory information. That's it. It's not something to be super discussed, at least for me. I don't know how it felt for you. The interlude is essentially just info dump for me. Good info dump, exciting info dump, but info dump. It does talk more about the character that I love, one of the characters I love the most, Nears.
Yeah, you also get some great stuff from Magnolia, and I love just the way that you get established who Magnolia is in just like the most hilariously casual way. I love how she's just, okay, I'm alone, time to flop. Do you know what it specifically makes me think of, Oshin?
What?
There is this series of pictures I see floating around, usually on like anime and nerd convention Facebook groups, where it's just a whole bunch of cosplayers in like I am not on right now moments. They're just kind of sitting there, and you got like Sailor Moon smoking a cigarette with a beer nearby. Just stuff like that, where you're seeing this moment where somebody who is generally very on, or at least in a situation where they look like they should be on, is just kind of switched the fuck off at the moment. And that's what I picture Magnolia as right now. Just flopping all over the couch, just done with it for a minute. Where's my cigarette?
I did enjoy it. So the chapter is essentially broken into three parts. One part Magnolia, one part Nears, and the other part is more of a conversation between a bunch of. It's a text conversation. So the first part, as he was talking about, is Magnolia flopping. And it's Magnolia not just flopping, but she's discussing all of the things that she knows and revealing the fact that she has a good enough information network to be able to tell what the hell's happening. She's even able to track the movements of the Antinium, who are trying to hide something, and she just drops bits of information here and here and here. Clearly, she's plugged in a way that not a lot of other people are, which is very scary. Information is power. Let's be real. This is a lot. This is when I started to think of Magnolia less as like a powerful noble girl boss person, whatever, and more as she's like the CIA. She's literally the CIA. She's everywhere. She's listening to. No, not the CIA. Do you know who the Stasi from East Germany? They were terrible, but they knew everything. Like she's in command of the Stasi. Like literally, she's everywhere.
I mean, so if you want to get, I think, more specific about it, neither the FBI or the CIA or the Stasi ever truly know everything, but they want to present the idea that they do so that whenever you do anything, you are looking over your own shoulder about it and thinking twice. And I feel like Magnolia is kind of the same way. She's hella well informed, but it's the image of Magnolia as hella well informed that is most important.
It's interesting to watch and to just like think it over. Just, I don't know, it expanded my mind in terms of how Magnolia was presented and what kind of power she is. So, soft touch, strong power. But then comes my personal love of this chapter, loved this part of the chapter, Nears. Oh my god, Nears is so much fun. Nears is so much fun!
Yes, and was this the big Nears reveal? This was the big Nears reveal, right?
No, I think he had a reveal before this where we kind of saw him.
Yeah.
We saw him because he was commanding a bunch of his troops and he was playing another.
You're right, you're right. My one issue is these two moments are introduced so similarly, I do occasionally flip them in my mind.
Yeah.
There's Nears in his tent, it's hot and muggy, there might be some sand.
Yeah, he's out on campaign again. But this one's a little bit more expanded. The other one was like a snapshot. This one's like a truly expanded. And you see Nier's functioning as a strategist in command of his army and the way he like casually crushes this giant trap that somebody laid for him that he was like, oh, I figured it out in 15 seconds and broke his trap. And then you see him like fuck with the other commander. You get a very good sense of Nier's as the type of person who will misdirect and will fuck with you psychologically. Remind you of anybody?
Yeah. And I also like the way that it sort of introduces a few other cool ideas and concepts. Because just from the beginning, the courier comes in and he's thinking about, the idea of magic clashing, which I want to say this is the first time we get mentioned that magic items will explode if they're too near each other.
Think so. It could be the second time, but I because the horns or somebody could have discussed it before.
Maybe. This is the first time that I'm noticing it in the reread, though. If it's somewhere else earlier, by all means, let me know. But also the letters that he's apparently been getting aggressively from Reinhardt, which are so on brand for Magnolia Reinhardt because they're so extra.
I mean, that's Magnolia's brand. She knows how to brand stuff, let's be real.
Yeah.
And the other thing about it is that Nier's is smart enough not to get caught up in it. But I don't know how to say this. Nier's is really cautious. It's weirdly cautious about what he does.
I mean, Magnolia's bad news in a lot of ways.
That's true.
At this point, especially in the story, I'm not convinced she's a bad person or, like, specifically aggressively an antagonist, but God, you get caught up in her bullshit, and who knows what's gonna happen.
True, true, and he.
And you know what? I think I get that impression because Nier's is so cautious of her here.
Exactly. That's what I was leading to, is that part of what gives me a good impression, like, not a good impression, but like an impression that Magnolia is a power, is Nier's. Nier's is represented as someone at the highest levels, very intelligent, very powerful, commanding lord of his army, blah, blah, blah. And then you have him going like a letter comes from with a rose scented letter comes from Magnolia Reinhardt. He goes like, no, not gonna read it. No. Take it away. And it just tells you what the level that you're playing on. Both Magnolia in that sense like reflects back onto Nier's level because she's reaching out to him. But on the other side, you see Nier's like respecting the power that she has and staying the hell away from her.
Yeah.
The other big thing in this section that's revealed is Nier's students.
Yeah, I was just remembering that like Umina and Venaz are here.
And Yurinola and Will is also introduced. So they're all here, and Nier's introduces the concept of bringing like student strategists here. You see him teaching people how to do their jobs, and they have some interesting theories about who is the chess opponent for Nier's Astorgan and his special. I still can't get over the fact that Venaz thought it's a dragon on the other end.
I mean, it being a dragon on the other end could actually have been legit. It was built up as a pretty interestingly mysterious potential thing. I mean, on his end, obviously, not on Eren's end, but.
There's a lot of like also emotional aspect to this. There's this entire section where we see Nier's create like a big metaphor about how he's so lonely and tragic a figure, and now he's not alone anymore in the world because there's somebody else just like him on the other end.
God, this is gonna sound so weird. I really can't talk about it without spoilers, but yeah, that's legit. That 100% kind of makes sense to me. This is a man at the top of his game who has conquered everybody who has tried to step to him in a way that I think leaves him with nobody that really is left on his level. 'Cause, Nier's isn't exactly one for leaving problems behind him.
Let's call it that in the nicest way. But Nier's, we go through his loneliness and his thing. But you also take a good look at the fact that, again, the caution is brought back. Nier's explicitly decides, despite having all this power and being connected to, he explicitly decides not to find out who his opponent is.
Yeah. Also, God, his line about how the winter sprites just forget to bring winter sometimes, and I'm like, I wonder if they're forgetting or if they're just only supposed to bring it every now and then, but nobody fucking can tell because they're all a bunch of rancid pieces of shit assholes who just refuse to cooperate in any reasonable way. God, I fucking hate the fairies so much sometimes.
Oh, tell me how you really feel.
I don't know why. I just they, my brain just kicked into gear, and I'm like, oh God, those fuckers.
All right, so the third section of the interlude is the conversation between Black Mage and a bunch of other people, including Humble Actor, Strider 47, 479, Loran Grimnar. Those are the three or four people. And it's done in the same style as the other text conversations have happened. And in it, it's clear that Black Mage has created some kind of connection between them and tried to track people. I love that in this section, Black Mage doesn't realize how much of a tool he's being by doing things like confirming that some certain people can't be tracked by first trying to track them.
I mean, he's being thorough. He's just also not,
I don't even know what to say. Maybe he is, maybe he's not. We don't really get to know in this one, but Lord, I just is that was so stupid. Like, why even try to track them in the first place?
Well, no. After what happened at the end of that last conversation, Oshi, where somebody has said their real name and could be in real, genuine danger, and like, you know somebody was spying and there's a whole bunch of problems. Why would you not try and track where they are? Especially if you have access to, you know, whatever resources it is that Black Mage has access to maybe help and protect them.
In summation, there's a bunch of revelations, people have a chat, and you begin to understand that there's a lot of things going on and that people are struggling in the real world, and we get to notice this I think this is Pirate sort of anointing the particular people who are speaking in this chat as maybe not being equivalent to Magnolia and Nears, but I do wonder if there's a thematic connection between it and if the kind of movements that they're having and the kind of conversation they're having will point to the fact that they are powers or will be powers in the future.
They're definitely hatching plans right now. There's no other way to put it. This is something of a conspiracy.
Yeah, they do talk about the spell, and yeah, and on the end of the thing, the last note from all of them is that Loran Grimnar thinks they can save the world. I don't know.
Yep, it's a well-meaning conspiracy, but they are absolutely forming a conspiracy right here and now.
Yeah. Okay, so that ends the interlude chapter, and Pirate Abba talks about in their author note the new subreddit for the Wandering Inn, which has grown to over 7,000 people. Can't wait till it gets to 10K. Woo, 10K. And that's just barely it. There's just a lot of like news drops. It's not really nuanced. It's just in your face about it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it. Unless you had any thoughts, let's move on to 239.
So, opening up into 239, we have Erin's return to her wonderful Leonette-filled home.
Infested home, you mean?
Infested, yes, Leonette-infested home.
She brings a lot of food with her that Magnolia has generously given her. And as soon as she comes back, a lot of her friends come following because they saw the pink carriage that she was on that came past.
Yeah, which is apparently a Magnolia signature.
And everyone comes by, like Celis, Rell, Kilbicage, Rags, and everyone just hangs out and has food. Erin talks about what's happened to her with the visit a little bit, and we do find out that, okay, one of the things that I mentioned in Volume 1 wrap up was the fact that Celis didn't know who Magnolia was, and this kind of makes up for it by showing that Celis does know who Magnolia is, she just doesn't recognize, connect the person that she knows as Magnolia to the name Magnolia Reinhardt, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I guess it kind of makes sense too when you think about like the history of everybody involved, just the way that people kind of only half pay attention when they're supposed to learn, the lack of a real education system around here. Like, it's legit enough. Also legit enough is that Erin is finally serving something that approaches alcohol in here. Relk almost cries.
It does end on a little bit of a sour note, though, when, okay, Garen Redfang, surprise, surprise, comes with Rags to the inn, and Rags stops Garen from, like, talking to anybody, which is hilarious. It's this moment, if there is something powerful when Relk It triggers his PTSD. Let's be real. It triggers his PTSD. And Relk has a meltdown. I don't know. He's literally trying to kill someone. And Eren has to confront Relk in the throes of his PTSD, in his hatred, in all of his stewing anger. He looks out at the goblins always as a sort of representation of everything that has gone wrong in his life, and he's clearly in that moment, and he reacts and he says, "You're not gonna stop me," and he threatens Torn, he threatens Eren, and Eren stands up to him. And in that moment, we see what Eren stands for, right?
Yeah, no, Eren takes no shits. I mean, God, this is just a hard chapter too, because you know that Relk means so much to her. And it breaks her heart to have to do it, but she's gotta throw him the fuck out.
And I don't know how to say this. It's just that moment where Eren establishes that it is her in, her rules, and she stands up to. Standing up to a friend can be one of the hardest things. Standing up to enemies, not a big deal. They're strangers to you. You don't have an emotional connection to them. But Eren stands up for what she believes in, and she has to do it against Relk, who she considers a friend. It's one of the hardest things a person has to do, to stand up to someone that they, I want to say love, but you understand,
Yeah.
it's a little too expensive. But yeah, it's not easy. And Eren does it for a principal, for a stranger, for this hob that she's never met, and for Rags, who she has. And Holric is there, and Celis supports her, and Kilbekich even supports her.
Honestly, if I think Kilbekich supporting her is part of what like got Relk to just back down and leave.
Yeah. On the other side of it, from Relk's perspective, you have to see it as, here is this person I consider a friend that I like. She isn't listening to me. She isn't seeing all of the horrible, disgusting, stanky shit that she's letting into her room. And she's doing this terrible thing by letting this. How could she be like this? How could she do this? How could this person that I like?
How could she take this risk? How could she ignore all the pain and suffering? And I mean, let's face it, it's not like he's wrong. That particular goblin has a past.
Like, we don't know that, David, but.
Well, we don't know that, and they don't know that, but at the same time, especially, with the way that it kind of works with hobs, you're never going to meet a hob that doesn't have, blood on their hands.
Yeah. But the point I'm trying to make is, from his perspective, he's not wrong. He's not. Like, no one here is exactly wrong. It's just a true difference of opinion, and it's very emotional, and it's very much of an emotional confrontation. And Relk finally leaves the inn and does not, like, his last words being, "I hope your damn tails fall off, all of you." And I don't know what other people felt. I felt like this was a pivotal moment for both Eren and for Relk, his development, because I wonder how many people have stood up to him like that. I wonder how many people have cared enough to stand up like that and to confront him about his reactions.
Probably very few because his reactions are not outside the norm of just what other people think and believe around here.
Yeah. And it was sad. It was sad. That's all I got.
Terribly, terribly sad, to quote the story. And, things don't get much better from there as everybody, quietly eats and things continue to be, tense.
Yeah, there's a pall, and then of course,
A wild Ryoka appears.
yeah, because what else is she gonna do? You want to talk about Ryoka?
I don't know if I ever want to talk about Ryoka, but this situation is both painful and complicated, but in a different way than the Relk one. Because in a lot of ways, both people in this argument are right. And it's really, I think, incredibly difficult for Ryoka and Mercia to come in from this terrible, god-awful situation they've been in. They come through the door, they then see that there's a bunch of goblins in the room, and Eren sees that Ryoka has gained plus one child, minus two fingers, and
And she has what her version of a reasonable reaction to extreme trauma, right? She does exactly what Relk would do. her buttons are pressed, and she starts lashing out, and that lashing out is Erin, because Erin mentions meeting Magnolia, and she has a panic moment, and then starts going like, "You're," my version of it would be cursing a lot. Hers is just calling her names, and Erin does not react well to that.
No. I mean, Ryoka's snide, self-important, "I'm better than you, I'm the smartest person in the room," really comes through here with some of the shit she calls Eren.
And Erin doesn't take her shit, punches her, and then Mercer tries to bite her, and all this shit happens. Essentially, it's a repeat of what happened with Relic, in that Erin stands up to Ryoka and her reaction, and forces her to confront it, and doesn't run away. This is a really good demonstration, I feel, of Erin's ability to, like, face the trauma that other people experiences and not run away. She accepts that people will have these reactions. She stands up for herself, but she doesn't try to dismiss it or deflect it or call them crazy or, disconnect from them. She's still their friend, even as they're having this reaction. That's hard to do for a lot of people. For anybody, yeah.
I mean, as much of a saint as she tries to be in this conversation, I also, I'll never blame anyone if they just really feel the urge to punch Ryoka Griffin in a conversation. Especially, God, some of the shit Ryoka calls her. Like, Ryoka just does not understand how to friend.
I don't even know what to tell you. It is what it is. This chapter was just very sad. It just was.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, Ryoko was crying, and even like everyone's crying a little bit, and things are falling apart. Yeah, that's where I was at the end of the chapter. Just a good example of confrontation and what it is like to stand up to your friends when they're acting like shits.
And how a good mood is never really allowed to last.
At least not in the Wandering Inn. War crimes. This one's not too war crimey, but it is like.
It is lonely, and despite myself, I really do feel for Ryoka as she just once again runs.
Yeah, well, she doesn't run at the end of this. Yeah,
Oh, that's right. She didn't run away at the end of this one.
she runs away at the end of the next one. Okay. Pirate writes in their note that they don't really like writing these kind of chapters because it's really hard on them because it has a lot of cursing, it has a lot of confrontation and emotional popping, but I think it's one of the better examples of pirates writing
Yeah.
in that they're very realistic in the confrontation.
It is something to be said for it's a very heavy chapter when you have the Relic and the Ryoka blow up at the same time. But you have to have it happen at the same time, just mechanically, right? Because it's not like Rags and Garen can pop in once a week so that they can do this again next week.
And then the next chapter is literally another disaster being connected to this one. So Eren takes Ryoka to meet with Kershaya after explaining the problems that happened with the shop burning down, and they introduce Mercia to her, and I don't know what to tell you. It goes about as well as expected.
It was mentioned actually just two chapters ago in the Magnolia chapter that, the white furred gnoll is a portent of some kind, although Magnolia couldn't remember what. Well, we have a much clearer idea what it means now, and it's bad.
And Ryoka talk, like, basically it's a chapter about Ryoka telling Eren what to do, and Eren being like, "Yeah, I'm okay. I'm good."
Yeah.
Ryoka clocks that Leonette's a princess instantly. Not even instantly, right?
Which is on yet another really fucking Ryoka really moment. Like, I realize Leonette doesn't do a great job hiding it, but it's one of those things that I look at and I think, oh, yay, Ryoka immediately sees her and figures it out. Of course she does.
I did love the scene between Ryoka and Kershaya and how they talk. She brought news of the death of Mercia's tribe.
This is another moment, though, of like Eren sort of standing up, and you know what? I think in some ways it is easier to stand up to your friends for Rags and for Rags's hob, for mysterious friend that's come with her. Because at the end of the day, you know that Rags deserves to be stood up for. But then you have to stand up and argue with Ryoka for the sake of Leonette. And that's when you see the real depths of Eren's character.
Yeah.
It's not safe for Leonette to send her out. It's not safe for her to be there. perfect either, but by God, Erin's gonna do what she can for the poor girl.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. Okay, technically, it's another like thing Ryoka does where she tries to do more than she's capable of. Not even more than capable of, just stupid things. She takes on Eren's debt, what the Nal tribe thinks that she owe, like Lynette owes. Okay, it's complicated with the
Yeah.
whole debt cycle thing, but.
It's not really a physical debt exactly. It's more of like a metaphorical blood price.
Right, because Lynette burns the shop, costs the entire Silverfang tribe one of their great treasures. Eren protects her, thus taking on the debt, and now Ryoka, as Eren's friend, takes on her debt and is promises to find something to pay it back, right?
Yeah, which, given some of the connections Ryoka has, this is one of the less stupid things she's ever done.
That's true. It is less stupid than it could have been. But it's another thing where like there's a chain of events that makes sense. I don't know. Mercia gets left behind. That's all I'll say.
I mean, Ryoka couldn't take Mercia running with her. She really couldn't. And not just because of some of the logistical problems. Frankly, I think those are manageable. I think at the end of the day, Ryoka knows she cannot be responsible for a tiny, fuzzy person.
And I get that, and then, okay, again, she's young, so I'm okay with this, but the way she leaves Mercia behind with Eren and isolates her even more, and she's left with her grief. Nobody's really, I don't know, there's so many things.
She did it in the worst possible way she could have, and it was a very self-centered way that allowed her to not have to suffer and put all the burden onto Eren and Mercia and Lynette. But I mean, I don't think clinically she's a narcissist. She's too capable of self-reflection when she does it, but she's a fucking narcissist.
I disagree. It's not narcissism. It's coping mechanism. Like, people make shitty decisions in bad times. It happens all the damn time. It just sucks that it happened to Mercia, to this little kid who hasn't done anything wrong. And now she's mute. She has white fur that marks her as, like, something evil to the Nal, general Nal population. And she's being left with total strangers after her whole family is dead and the only person who protected her is running away.
Yeah, and I would be more willing to give Ryoka credit for it as her specific in this moment coping mechanism if it wasn't kind of a pattern with her.
Well, it doesn't become a pattern until later, but this is like the start of said pattern.
No, because think about it. She has her big blow up and she argues with Saria and them and then she runs away. Now she has her big blow up with Eren and she gets into her argument with her and then she runs away. Also abandoning all responsibility and, like, everything in both cases. That smells like a pattern to me.
Yeah, and then they go back to the and when they come back to the inn, it was. They have a short interaction with the Fae, and the Fae leave them alone just because Mercia's crying, which was nice. I think that was a nice touch, right?
Yeah, no, for all of their problems, the Fae can occasionally show common fucking decency, at least to children. Also, I want to say that the Fae floating around here are the ones that Eren had dinner with, so they probably are just more generally inclined to be nice.
And of course, Ryoka has a similar reaction to Relk. With the goblins that are in the inn, but she does leave it alone. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not like they're permanent residents, they're leaving, and honestly, to actually tackle that problem long term, Ryoka would not have to leave. And Ryoka's not leaving, so.
And then we kind of get to see a little bit of. I mean, I'm not in favor of like using, but when you go through extreme trauma, coping mechanisms don't necessarily always work, and they can be damaging in their own ways. So here, Eren tries to help everybody by giving them the fairy flower drink, right?
Yeah, which she's of course still experimenting with and understanding the limitations and consequences of herself, and it seems mostly harmless. Mostly.
It seems mostly hard, and I wonder how helpful it is to Ryoka, who clearly has a chemical imbalance level of mental illness, which means. Because she was taking meds before. I wonder if it actually helps like rebalance her a little bit. I don't know.
I don't know. For Ryoka, I think it might be actually worse. For somebody like we've seen with some people where they take the fairy flower drink and it's mostly just kind of helping them relive a moment and process past trauma, or perhaps relive a moment and wallow in it instead of processing past trauma. Jury's still out. With Ryoka, I think that the fact that it's not specifically addressing that chemical problem could cause it to be worse for her, because it's a momentary feeling better, followed by immediately being dropped or being lowered, if depending on how immediate it is, back into that normal state, which is, not a good one.
Yeah, not a great one. On the other hand, it does help those who are more chemically balanced, folks like Halric and Mercia. And it does seem to help them like find some balance, some moment of peace. It definitely helps them sleep, which is kind of important
Oh yeah.
because sleep is one of the bigger ways we process, like we process it in our sleep. It's just, ugh, it was really good. I did enjoy that bit. I do like the fact that the Fae were really like shocked that Eren kept the flowers and used them.
Yeah, you gotta adore the way that Eren just. It's gonna sound weird. Her determination to believe that the fairies must have dealt with her in good faith meant that she got way more out of their trick than she would have if she just was cynical and said, "Oh, they tricked me," and threw everything out.
Yeah, and it was a gift, so they can't take it back, so no takesies backsies. And then they go have a drink from Eren's inn, and I do find it interesting that Eren was able to use something gifted by the Fae, the ever-present immortal beings, and then transform it into something else, because I don't know how much Pirate Abbas has read tales about using Fae gifts for things that they're not supposed to be used for. Yeah, that doesn't usually go well. But this one, it is a little odd because the Fae gifted her this, and they had no intention that she shouldn't use it. And then I guess Pirate undercuts it by having the Fae be like, oh, it's funny. Okay, cool. She can use it that way.
I mean, at the end of the day, yes, the Fae are tiny little piece of shit, so their deciding factor is this is gonna be funny. So at the end of the day, whatever goodwill or potential trickery they might have been able to inflict on her here is lost. Although, God, this conversation about the Fae reminds me of something. I just heard of this series yesterday, and now I've forgotten the name. But it is a series that is a modern fantasy, urban fantasy, where you have to deal with fae a lot. And the trick they had is that you should always speak to fae in Latin, because it's a dead language. Its meaning is effectively locked in place. The words can never be twisted.
That's a cool trick. If I knew how to speak Latin, maybe it would work for me.
Yeah, same. If I had to deal with Fae regularly, I might pick it up. And I wish I could remember the name of this series now, because that sounded really cool, and now I gotta go pester a friend again.
Okay, so Pirate Abba's note, author note for this is, actually, I want to read this one out because it's kind of gives you a frame into Pirate's mind in this case. Implication, period. When he said her tribe was gone, he also said it was her fault. Is that clear from the context? Or should I make that more explicit, the part that he's not saying? I did edit it to make it more obvious. Thanks for pointing that out, Patreon readers. A second sad chapter, but here's the thing. I do have the luxury of telling a longer story. And frankly, I doubt either Mercia or Ryoka can get over this that fast. It's a meaningful chapter, I feel, in a number of ways. I definitely have the sense the second half is stronger than the first half, though. Regardless, I hope you liked it. I'll be starting more guestbook entries tomorrow, so send me any requests for what you like written, who you'd like to write the entry. I'll also put the side story poll soon as well. Thanks for reading. Okay, so this goes over a lot of stuff Pirate's been doing, and I wanted to mention it. One, Pirate does alter the text of the document based on feedback that they get when they're within a few days of like writing stuff to clarify things, and they did it a lot more free form in the old days. Nowadays they have like the typo squad and they have a beta group to read and then they have like discussions and edit phases and all that, but this was way before in the days. And the other thing is they used to do like guest book stuff. Do you remember the guest book?
Yes.
It was great. I kind of wish we could come bring back the guest book just a little bit, but I don't think Pirate has time considering all the writing that they do, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and the side story stuff was fun, and yeah, I mean, Pirate talks a lot about context and how they are writing a longer story, so they spend more time in the minutiae of grief, of anger, of the depths of all that stuff. It's my argument against a lot of people who are like, okay, Pirate uses 20 words when they could use five. Yes, they use 20 words, but that 20 words isn't about what you think it is. It isn't trying to reach the same goal. And those 20 words is giving us context in a different way. They're not useless words. They're there for a reason, and they're there for context and clues and things that have nothing to do necessarily with going from one plot to two plot to three plot. No. But if you're looking for one plot to two plot to three plot, you have the entirety of every published work ever in the last 200 years that has been, whose structural form has been determined by these trade publishers. Go read that. This is a web serial. It's supposed to take in the moments. It's supposed to be talking about all these little things and giving us these impressions and helping us feel like it's every moment to moment and not just
Yeah.
running freight train, right?
I've said this before, but it reminds me a lot of that sort of pre-modern publishing era when a lot of stuff was published piecemeal in magazines, and you would pay, God, what's his name? The Hunchback of Notre Dame guy, Victor Hugo?
Yeah, Victor Hugo.
Yeah, Victor Hugo by the word, and by God, he would write some words. Like, actually go and read something like fucking Les Mis at some point, and it's similar. Obviously, they didn't have the power of the word count pirate has access to, but you would get similar
But it
tone.
is verbose.
Yeah, it was verbose, and it did kind of find itself wanting to settle and explore a specific emotional moment more thoroughly than you would get in modern publishing, because hey, that's an extra $20, right? Like, yeah.
Right. And a lot of folks react violently to that as if it's like a crime. No, there aren't rules in writing except what we choose to make. And then the argument becomes, well, they developed this tradition and they clearly know. Yes, they developed the tradition. They clearly know what they're doing in the tradition that they developed. Other people can develop other ways of writing. This is why folks don't read non-English writing because they don't understand the restructuring. Like, Russian literature does not follow the same shit. Okay, I'm getting really huge.
Or hell, to use a more specific, a more extreme example that I think highlights it better, there is a reason why at the end of the day, just filming a musical is not the same as going to that musical.
Absolutely.
Because the mediums have fundamentally different rules. And even within mediums, those rules can get more granular, both into genre and style. And listen, there actually maybe are rules, but I'm not smart enough to know them. But one of the rules is probably that there are not specific rules. So maybe we just stop worrying about the rules and then we focus more on the rules, right?
I mentioned this again because I've been ever since the AMA, prior to the AMA, I've been struggling a lot with getting people to like engage with Pirate Abba's work, and always it's that same, I don't want to read this because it doesn't follow the structure that I have always read. I just don't know how to.
It's slice of life.
Yeah.
Slice of life has its own rules and its own specific structure, and Wandering In follows them actually fairly well.
Yeah.
Now, it does so in a way that makes it clear that it is also its isekai fantasy action, whatever, but fundamentally, it structures itself as a slice of life.
And that's a crime to a lot of people because they find slice of life boring. Because if there isn't action every page, then they're not going to be interested. Which I find.
Also, I mean, a lot of slice of life can be pretty fucking boring. Like, it's a hard genre to write well.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Okay, and on that note, boring slice of life, I think we're at an end for this episode.
Indeed, we are. Thank you for listening to our rambling for 1 hour and 20 minutes about books and other books and then some other books.
And we'll ramble on next week. See you then. Bye, everybody.
See you then. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.